Welcome to El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine. International Federation of Clinical Chemistry, IFCC. Executive Director, Dr. Hernan Ferris-Tayeb.
Member of the Committee of Evidence-Based Laboratory Medicine of the International Federation of Clinical Chemistry.
Organizing Committee, Dr. Maria Montserrat Blanes-Gonzalez from Paraguay, Dr. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico, and Dr. Estela Raimondo from Uruguay.
El Microscopio, a program exclusively dedicated to clinical chemistry.
El Microscopio. Register in our website, www.infobioquimica.com, and receive El Microscopio's newsletter with information of new programs and the most relevant news of the week.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
The Spanish Association of Pharmaceutical Analysts and the Chilean Society of Clinical Chemistry accompany El Microscopio.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
Professor Paolo Sarti is full professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the Department of Biochemical Sciences at Sapienza University of Rome, Italy. He is specialist in gastroenterology, anatomy and histopathology and general pathology. He has been awarded the title of research professor at New York University. In this interview, he is talking about biochemistry, physiology and pharmacology of oxidative stress.
Biochemistry, physiology and pharmacology of this oxidative stress. And why that? Because oxidative stress is actually is a great issue. I mean, I don't know whether you're familiar. I mean, people which are familiar with this issue, they know that the oxidative stress argument, problems, let's say problematics, started in the 1980s, let's say. So it's more than, it's about 30 years ago, I would say. And since then, when we started studying, I'm saying we, because I'm a biochemist, you know, and so, we started first, so to speak. And so when we started, we didn't realize that, as a matter of fact, that this the problem of the oxidative stress was such a huge problem, and the issue was so big, involving most of the diseases of our diseases, the human diseases. So this is the reason why we've been collecting these people together here in Rome, also because they like Rome, I think, I hope, actually. But, mostly because we do love here in Rome. We have good people, in Italy, actually, I should say, and now they've been collected in Rome, good people working on biochemistry of the oxidative stress, working on physiology and pharmacology of the oxidative stress and biotechnology. This is particularly from Ferrara. I don't know whether you want to know the names of these people, for instance. I don't know whether this is. Of course, Luciano Sasso is a very good pharmacologist and physiologist in Rome, as well as Giuseppe Balacchi in Ferrara, and Paolo Bovicelli is a chemist. You know, the point is that we need all this. It is a kind of combination of people because the material is, the issue is rather wide. So it includes the so many disciplines. So biochemistry, indeed, let's start with biochemistry, because, of course, biochemistry is the mother of all these disciplines, so to speak. Without chemistry and biochemistry, I should say, nothing is understood. And then we introduce everybody else to the problematics. And then physiology. Physiology, the viewpoint of physiology is kind of integrated. So they tend to watch at problems, to look at problems in an integrated way, more integrated than we do. From the biochemistry point of view, we try to look at single little steps, let's say, and overall steps as well. But, physiology does it. It's its purpose. Then pharmacology, of course, because pharmacology wants to you know, to act on the processes. Pharmacology is kind of, I would say, exogenous something to our body. We all know that we're taking pills. You know, we these kind of things, which are so important in order to readdress, you know, something which went wrong, so to speak, in terms of, you know, pathways. So that's the reason why, I mean, we all together, now these 100 people from all over the world, the best people came out. Should be very, very happy about that, because it, I mean, it was quite a good, I don't know how to use the word answer, but it was a good answer of the international, scientific community to this call that we made. So this is as far as it's 3 days. It actually is one full day and then a morning, and an afternoon. So it's overall it's 2 days with a number of sections, including from the mechanisms. We start with biochemical mechanisms, and then we keep going on to the physiology, as I said, and then pharmacology of a number of diseases where the antioxidant or oxidant problematic or problems is more rich, you know. And the reason why, you know, this is something very peculiar, I would say, and this is a really a hot spot in terms of this antioxidant and, you know, and radical scavenging and this kind of thing, this kind of chemistry, very fancy and funny chemistry, so to speak, that started once again kind of 20, 30 years ago, recognizing that, air pollutants, you know, the oxides, you heard about that? I think you did. I mean, like nitric oxide, like carbon monoxide, you know, carbon monoxide from our cars, so to speak. These oxides, we thought that were just pollutants, so something absolutely toxic to avoid it. And in fact, it is. It's like that. Because, you know, our cars, they do produce huge amount of these compounds. And whereas our body, our cells in our body, they do produce very little, minute amounts of these gases, the same gases, like carbon monoxide, like nitric oxide, like hydrogen sulfide, you know, which is not an oxide, as a matter of fact. But, I mean, small molecules, gaseous molecules, which are produced to make cell signaling. You know, cell signaling means that, either inside any cell, our cells, or among cells, they do talk one to the other, or you know, among each other, they do talk using these molecules to communicate, so to speak, and to react, as a matter of fact. And this is not just, you know, kind of trivial, let's say. It's not at all. Because, you know, for instance, if you stop doing this into cells which are forming the internal coating of our vessels, arteries, for instance, so if you stop, for instance, the production of nitric oxide by the so-called endothelial nitric oxide synthase, which is produced inside the endothelium, then what happens is that we cannot survive. You know, in our body, it happens that people having such a disease would actually immediately develop hypertension in such a way that this hypertension would bring to, you know, to death, so to speak, so to be clear, let's say, on one side. On the other side, something similar happens with carbon monoxide in our brain. Just imagine carbon monoxide, you know, the most venomous oxide, you know, people dying for carbon monoxide in the mountains when it's cold, these kind of things. Well, yeah, that's true. But I mean, carbon monoxide produced by the heme oxygenase, this is the name of the enzyme that produces carbon monoxide in the cells. Carbon monoxide vasodilate our vessels together with nitric oxide and H2S. You know, these three gases, that's why we call it the three gaseotransmitters. These three gases have gained over the time a real importance. Without them, we cannot survive. As a matter of fact, it's a very good paradigm in terms of showing, the way it goes. You know, biochemistry found it, and then physiology realized what was happening to our body overall. And eventually, you know, the pharmacology came into play. And I'm sure that you remember, you know, for instance, nitric oxide. I don't know whether you heard about, you know, the Nobel Prize won by Ignaro. Did you heard about it? So, I mean, this is not recent. I mean, it's kind of 10, 15 years ago. He won this Nobel Prize, and this was because, he found that nitric oxide was the so-called X compound making the vasodilation. So, recovering, for instance, for heart attack due to ischemia. No, this was due to the nitric oxide, and eventually came out, you know, with some drugs, releasers of nitric oxide. Well, the most popular was another something. It was Viagra, which has nothing to do with heart attacks. But I mean, it's good for health as well. I mean, as a matter of fact.
We are in El Microscopio on infobiochimica.com.
On Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Argentina time.
At 10 a.m.
El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Costa Rica time.
I remember the
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Alberto Barrantes in Costa Rica. Álvaro Justiniano Gross in Bolivia. Ana Leticia Maselli in Guatemala. Carmen Cecilia Almonacid Urrego in Colombia. Cristina Cerveto from Uruguay. Eduardo Aranda in Chile. Graciela Velázquez from Paraguay. María del Carmen Pasquel from Ecuador.
El Microscopio, a way of looking at knowledge.
In El Microscopio, we continue with the interview of Professor Paolo Sarti about biochemistry, physiology and pharmacology of oxidative stress.
And what are the major targets for human diseases related to redox chemistry?
Yeah, redox chemistry. Well, you know what? This is an important, very important, this is the most crucial one, actually, because while we know everything, about, I mean, everything, a lot, about these gaseous transmitters, I mean, they are three molecules, whereas the redox chemistry is an overall chemistry, is a really wide chemistry that includes antioxidant, for instance, you know, the meaning is an antioxidant, but includes also the pro-oxidant. And, you know, this is the real frontier of our meaning. Because, you know, since over, let's say that over the last 20 years, or almost 20, even more actually, over the 20 years, we've been talking about preventing oxidation. You know what I mean with oxidation? So, I mean, just for a few words, whenever you say that the molecule is oxidized, a molecule oxidized is losing, actually, partly, I mean, some electrons, let's say. So electrons are getting out, are withdrawal by from, actually, the molecule. And, of course, electrons cannot just go around. They are accepted to some other molecules. So whenever you are taking electrons from, let's say, A, this is now A, I mean, this electron is entering into B, let's say, which is reduced. So whenever we have an oxidation, we have a reduction as well going together. Electrons are moving. So we said antioxidant or antioxidant, I mean, the way you want to say, means that you are trying to keep electrons in one place, in one molecule, which means that you have to take electrons from another place and feed electrons to the molecule that you want to preserve, isn't it? So antioxidants are those, all those compounds, and all those drugs eventually, we hope, that are able to, you know, to release electrons, so to prevent from oxidation, so from losing of electrons, of molecules which otherwise would not work. You know what I mean with would not work? I mean that it is true that, let's say, evolution has developed, of course, did things very well, actually, as a matter of fact. But, I mean, this is obvious. But evolution has set molecules in a way that the amount of electrons, let's say, included per molecule is ideal, so to speak. And so whenever, with aging, for instance, with disease, cancer, you know, we can make a list. It's a long list of conditions where our molecules, now I'm talking about, you know, our, you know, favorite molecules like DNA molecules, like proteins, like enzymes, like cell membrane proteins and these kind of things, or the the cell membranes per se. So all these molecules, whenever they lose electrons, so for disease conditions, for aging conditions, sort of disease, so to speak, we need to have a reservoir of electrons to be fed in back. And this is that now, so let's go back to the beginning, when I said that the antioxidant, the antioxidants have been the major goal of our biochemistry and physiology and pharmacology. But now we've been realizing it. And when I'm saying now, I'm saying these days, the new publication said, people involved in this with us chemistry is coming out saying it's not a problem of antioxidant. It's a problem of redox balance, which has to be correct. So it's the correct equilibrium between electron fed in and withdrawal out that is the real problem that we are facing, we have to face. And, we're doing this correctly in good health, so to speak, because in good health, everything works perfectly. You know, it's not a problem. Whenever we're having, for instance, this balance can change towards more oxidation or more reduction. Both actually are not good for us. And this was not true a couple of years ago, people would say, oh, the problem is the oxidation. Well, it's not true now. We have to discuss whether it's only oxidation that is a problem, but also, excess reduction might well be a problem. I can give an example. I mean, the example is, for instance, cancer therapy. Because in cancer therapy, for instance, we definitely have to look at this balance, because some of the drugs are working very well if there is a good balance between reducing and oxidative power. And these, is a parameter that's to be looked after, let's say.
The major guidelines in science about antioxidants, could you please tell us about them?
Yeah, antioxidants, right. So, let's say that as far as antioxidants, we have to think about having at least two major containers, let's say, of antioxidants. First container is absolutely natural. It's nature. So most antioxidants that we are, entering in our bodies, are coming from food. And we have so many food antioxidant donors, let's say, in what we are eating most of the time. I would say all of us. You know what? Whenever you see a color, so whenever you see something that has a color, you're watching from the chemical point of view, of course, you're watching something which is a polyphenol or an anthocyanin. I don't know whether the pronunciation is correct in English, or American, but anthocyanins, or flavonoid. This kind of compounds, they all have exert a very good anti-radical property. They do have it. And of course, they are also antioxidants, so to speak. So they are electron donor. But You know what? I have to tell you, because I'm talking to biochemists, I realized that whenever you have a substance that is able to donate electrons, it's also able to accept electrons, it would depend on the midpoint potential, you know, or of the compound that you're looking at. And therefore, this means what I said. This means that there will be a level for a redox level for all these substances, a level of reduction oxidation where they can act in, say, on both directions. Of course, there will be a major direction in our body, because in our body, we know that the midpoint potential, you know, we know the midpoint potential of our cells. And that can be different, as a matter of fact. But, I mean, well, let's go back to antioxidants, sorry. So, natural and artificial. As I said, we can even follow a kind of color code, so to speak, of these substances. Whenever you see, as I said, you know, dark violet, for instance, or blue or pink, you know, blueberries, you know, raspberries, or I don't know whether the pronunciation is correct now. I mean, whenever you know the goji berries, have you heard about goji berries? It's a Chinese berry that is becoming absolutely popular all over the world, and China is the major producer of this. I mean, fields and fields of these berries that will, you know, I mean, here in Italy, they're very, very popular now. They are also incredibly expensive, as a matter of fact. This is a very good business for these people. And these berries, for instance, they do contain, let's put the content in antioxidant as 100, right? So we fix 100, you know, in this percentage scale. So we fix 100, their content. If you now are watching our, you know, the blueberries are quite, you know, quite good as antioxidants. Well, they are only 5% of that. So to say, how powerful is that? And the, you know, the, I don't know whether the pomegranate, you know the pomegranate?
Yes.
Pomegranate?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know it?
Yes.
Right. So pomegranate is a very good fruit in terms of, you know, radical scavenging or antioxidant. And this, let's put it in this scale, about 30. So it's 30% of the goji berries. So this is just to say that the Chinese you know, are lucky in that, let's say. But, you know, there's so many other foods, artichokes, you know, I know, it's not counting my mind, you know, tomatoes. You know, whenever you see color, you see cyanins, anthocyanins, sorry, you see polyphenols, and all, I mean, the tea, of course, black tea. If, I mean, green tea is well known, but also black tea, is they do contain a lot of this, anti radicals. And then we have the second container. So the first container is the natural. The second container is the artificial one, where we've been mimicking simply, you know, chemists. What do they do? All over the world. I mean, in India, for instance, they have very good, you know, schools where they teach and do actually synthesis of this kind of compounds. They're very good in doing that. So means that they are simply mimicking what is in nature, and you know, they're trying to improve it indeed, and to make pills that should be taken instead of, you know, eating myrtles or goji berries, let's say. What else can I say about that? Do you have something to ask me? To help me? No, I don't think. I mean, is that too much?
No, it's very good. In fact, I want.
Well, you know what? This is myrtle.
Uh-huh.
Watch it.
Uh-huh.
Can you see?
Yes.
I'm fine with the daily income. And then if I'm eating some tomatoes, I'm even, you know, above. Carrots, you know, the red carrots, even, you know. So they say, well, we are entering there's so much food and so many antioxidants that there is no reason for being worried about being deprived of it. And this makes sense in one way. On the other side, people pro antioxidants, they would say, yeah, of course, but I mean, the ingestion is not just, it's not the whole process, it's just the beginning of the process. Then you have to, you know, enter this into your bloodstream and then goes into the cells. And this may take, you know, additional steps which may not work perfectly in your body. So, but this needs to be discussed. As I said, this is our frontier now. So we have to find the balance, the good balance between reducing power and oxidative power, and we have to find, to combine this information with the income, with the daily income, these antioxidants.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. It's been really a very nice interview, and it's been a pleasure to have you in the Microscopio.
All right, thank you.
All right.
El Microscopio.
In www.infobiochimica.com, you'll find a link to the Clinical Chemistry Training Council and consultation website of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine.
We are in El Microscopio on infobiochimica.com
on Wednesday at 1 p.m.
Argentina time
and at 12 p.m.
Paraguay, Puerto Rico, Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Chile, and Cuba time.
God in a war, no one's laughing at God when they're starving or freezing or so very poor. No one laughs at God when a doctor calls after some routine tests. No one's laughing at God when it's gotten real late and their kid's not back from that party yet. No one laughs at God when their airplane starts to uncontrollably shake. No one's laughing at God when they see the one they love hand in hand with someone else and they hope that they're mistaken. No one laughs at God when the cops knock on their door and they say, "We got some bad news, sir." No one's laughing at God when there's a famine, fire, or flood. But God could be funny at a cocktail party while listening to a cooking joke. But when the crazy say he hates us and they get so red in the head, you think they're about to choke. God could be funny when told he'll give you money if you just pray the right way. And when presented like a genie with his magic like Houdini, or grants wishes like Jiminy Cricket and Santa Claus, God could be so hilarious, ha ha. Lost all they got and they don't know what for. No one laughs at God on a day they realize that the last sight they'll ever see is a pair of hateful eyes. No one's laughing at God when they're saying their goodbyes. But God could be funny at a cocktail party while listening to a cookout theme joke. Or when the crazy say he hates us and they get so red in the head you think they're about to choke. God could be funny when told to give you money if you just pray the right way. And when presented like a genie with his magic like Houdini, or grants wishes like Jiminy Cricket and Santa Claus, God could be so hilarious. But no one laughs at God in a hospital. No one laughs at God in a war. No one laughs at God in a hospital. Starving or freezing or so very poor. No one's laughing at God. one's laughing at God. No one's laughing at God. We're all laughing with God.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world. Our correspondents in every country. Rosa Isabel Sierra Amor from Mexico. José Jara from Peru. Milagros de la Rosa from Dominican Republic. Miriam Aguilera from Honduras. Rafael Calafel from Spain. Mario Chavez Villalobos from Costa Rica. Dante Yáñez from Bolivia. Leverton Ortiz from Chile.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
CALILAB 2014, 6th Conference on Clinical Laboratory Quality and the 7th Argentine Congress of Clinical Laboratory Quality from November the 5th to 8th in Mar del Plata, Argentina.
El Microscopio. Agenda. Offering courses, workshops, seminars, congresses.
Agenda. El Microscopio. AACC 2015. Annual meeting and exhibition of laboratory medicine. July the 26th to the 30th, Atlanta, Georgia, United States. For more information, you can visit www.aacc.org. 6th Conference and Exhibition about Analytical Techniques, September the 1st to the 3rd, 2015, in Spain. For more information, you can visit www.analyticalbioanalytical.com.
Agenda.
4th European Congress of Immunology, September the 6th to the 9th, 2015, in Vienna, Austria.
El Microscopio.
8th Congress of the Croatian Society of Clinical Biochemistry and Laboratory Medicine, with international participation.
Agenda.
September 22nd to 26th, 2015, in Croatia. 22nd Congress in Latin America of Clinical Biochemistry and Laboratory Medicine, Colabiocli.
Agenda.
September 24th to 26th, 2015, in Quito, Ecuador. For more information, you can visit www.sebioclic.org. 23rd Conference of the Balkan Clinical Laboratory Federation, October the 7th to the 9th, 2015, in Bosnia. 13th National Congress of Biochemistry, Cuba. October the 7th to the 10th, 2015, in San Fernando del Valle de Catamarca, Catamarca, Argentina.
Agenda.
For more information, you can visit www.cubra2015.com.ar.
El Microscopio, an online radio program about biochemistry. This is El Microscopio.
On infobioquimica.org.
News.
Introducing the IFCC eAcademy. eAcademy, the new IFCC educational tool, is being developed by the CDL and CLEL. The first phase of the project, now available on the IFCC website, is an interactive curriculum-based approach to catalog and facilitate access to educational material for use by all members of the worldwide IFCC community. Content is currently being developed and will be uploaded to expand the freely available educational resources on a wide range of laboratory medicine topics. The next phase of the project will be to develop a learning management system, which will allow us users to self-assess and receive credit for assessing material. For more information, you can visit www.ifcc.org.
News.
The 21st IFCC EuroMedLab Congress in Paris has now closed. Congratulations to the Congress Organizing Committee and to the visitors from the laboratory medicine community, representing 106 countries around the world.
News.
APFCB is pleased to announce a Young Scientist Competition, which commences in June 2015. There will be 5 winners of the competition, and each will be invited to present their research paper at the APFCB Symposium during the APFCB Congress in Taipei, Taiwan, 2016. The top 2 will also receive additional awards. We would very much like to see our young scientists coming forward as the future leaders in laboratory medicine in the APFCB region.
Crying all the times, 50 boys, 50 lies, 50 I'm
Professor Michael Korns is the Principal Clinical Scientist and Clinical Chemistry Department at New Cross Hospital, West Midlands, United Kingdom. In this interview, he's talking about Oat of Truth. Is it a myth or science?
Professor Michael Korns, welcome to Microscopio.
Thank you.
In this interview, we are going to talk about the Oat of Truth, and we wanted to ask you, what analyte does it affect and how?
The order draw it can affect many analytes depending on how gross the contamination is. I mean, the idea of order draw is to prevent contamination from certain samples to another. If at its worst case, this can actually be pouring from one tube to another, which would obviously cause a dilution effect on other additives. But more specifically, we specifically see problems with analytes such as sodium and potassium, which occur in some tubes. The additive exists as a sodium potassium salt. So the obvious example is a potassium EDTA. If that gets into a routine gel tube that you want to analyze potassium in, if you've actually got an additive of potassium in there, you get really high potassium results. And the problem occurs when you get slight contamination, so you get a slightly raised potassium, causing believable results, which can then affect patient care. The other thing with things like potassium and sodium EDTA is the actual EDTA itself. Chelates, divalent metal ions such as zinc, calcium, magnesium, and this causes results for those analytes to be low. And they also can act as cofactors to other enzymes such as alkaline phosphatase, so you can get falsely low results in enzymes. So that, as you can see, the kind of potential for interference in assays due to using the wrong tube type or the wrong order of draw resulting in contamination is potentially huge.
Why is some literature claiming that the order of draw is a myth?
There have been quite a few studies, including a couple that I've done myself, where if you actually try and mimic incorrect order of draw in a laboratory situation and bleed patients and bleed them deliberately in the wrong order, you actually you don't see any effect on analytes to analyte in the lab. Now, the drawback of this is when you set up a scientific experiment to do this, you have to use standard procedures. And obviously, when we're bleeding patients, we will follow the manufacturer's guidelines to the letter on how you actually take the samples. So there's a lot of evidence out there saying that if you do the phlebotomy procedure in the correct way, according to the manufacturer's instructions, there is actually no risk of contamination due to incorrect order of draw. And we've proved this by actually measuring EDTA in samples before and after an EDTA tube's been taken. So papers that claim it's a myth, I have to agree with to some extent, because in ideal situations, there is minimal risk and there's no reason that you need to follow any order of draw. However, it does occur. So, and in the real world, in certainly in emergent departments, the ability to follow manufacturer's instructions for phlebotomy is not always possible, and it's certainly not used. So order of draw is still important.
And do you think the order of draw is important, or can it be ignored?
My feeling is it's very important, and I've done several studies. We started off doing a study just in our own lab where we actually looked to detect EDTA on all of our raised potassium results. And several of these would have been picked up anyway by our lab staff without having to measure EDTA. And this is, as I mentioned earlier, this is when you've got a gross contamination that's been poured in and you get potassium results that are just not compatible with life. However, we also have picked up many, many cases where the potassium is at a believable level and we've released the result. But we've then subsequently, when we've measured EDTA, found that it's present and found that the result is in fact false. And we actually went on from this to do this across multiple hospitals in my region. We did six different sites and which encompassed three different tube manufacturers. And we actually found that of these, 4% of raised potassiums were actually due to EDTA contamination. But more importantly, using the current lab staff judgment, we found that only 50% of the 4% of EDTA contaminated samples were actually picked up during normal working practice. So there's 2% of raised potassiums in our region are actually falsely raised and not reported or identified as falsely raised. So my simple answer is I think, yes, it is still important because the ideal phlebotomy procedure is not always followed. And there is evidence and studies that have observed this, showing that syringe use is quite high. And as I said, I've proved that EDTA contamination does occur, so order of draw does remain very important.
And how should laboratories detect and deal with incorrect order of draw to ensure correct patient results?
I think it's important that we continue to educate phlebotomists and anyone taking the blood that the order of draw is important, and it's important to publicise why and show them the evidence that it is having an effect. And I think at the core, as well as publicising this, it's something that's already practiced, and it's not difficult. It's no real hindrance to the phlebotomist to take the tubes in a certain order because they're going to be taking the tubes anyway, so it doesn't really... It's got no effect on their time or any difficulty what order they take. It's very easy to do. And we should also, the lab itself should have measures to try and pick up these contaminations. The gold standard for potassium EDTA would be to actually measure EDTA ideally on all samples, but at a minimum on all raised potassiums or on all low calciums. Or if you haven't got a specific assay or you don't want to develop an assay to measure things, the actual contaminants like EDTA, you can look at surrogate markers. So, for instance, if you have a raised potassium, you could then further analyse calcium or zinc to see if they're actually low. And you can start to identify a pattern that looks like EDTA contamination. and then ask the clinician, please can you repeat this, because yes, the potassium is high, but we're not convinced it's actually a genuinely high result. Please can you repeat to confirm it? And by having these mechanisms in place, we can hopefully minimise any impact on the patient and mistreatment that might occur.
Is there any final comment you would like to make, Professor Korn?
My only final comment is I think that all of this work showing that the order of draw is a myth, it's all scientifically very good. But we really need to remember how practice is actually performed out on the wards and in the emergency departments. And a colleague of mine at a neighbouring hospital has shown that in an emergency department close to here, actually only 6% of blood samples in the emergency department are taken using the ideal situation, which is used in these studies showing that it doesn't exist. And in fact, 52% of emergency department samples are taken via syringe. And we can hypothesise that syringe needle contamination is the probable route that cross-contamination now happens. We're yet to prove that, but it's our current hypothesis. So I think it's very important to remember that, yes, scientific studies are very good, but they use a gold standard, standardised procedure. And we need to keep in mind what actually happens on the wards and in the emergency departments.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you in Microscopia.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
22nd Latin American Congress of Clinical Biochemistry and Laboratory Medicine, Colabiocle, 2015. From the middle of the world towards the clinical biochemistry of the new millennium. From October 29th to 31st in Quito, Ecuador.
This is El Microscopio on infobioquimica.com.
El Microscopio in the world, our correspondents in every country. Stella Raimondo from Uruguay, Fernando Ruiz Cerda from Chile, Montserrat González from Paraguay, Isabel Fierro from Ecuador, José Francisco Valle from Mexico, Oswaldo Ruiz Narváez from Costa Rica, Patrocinio Truecas from Spain, Rodolfo Aquino Cáceres from El Salvador.
Shut us on. mother's side. Where comedians laugh, babies cry. Where criminals are televised, politicians fraternize, journalists are dignified, and everyone is civilized, and children stare with heroin eyes. Heroin eyes. Heroin eyes. Oh, England. Oh, England. Oh, England is
the team of El Microscopio. Hernan Ferris Taye.
Hernan Ferris Taye.
Silvana Bujan.
Silvana Bujan.
Nicolas Bem.
Nicolas Bem.
Sebastian Zener.
Sebastian Zener.
Belen Landi.
Belen Landi.
And Marcelo Elias.
And Marcelo Elias.